Welcome to Stories That Matter, the Hawkwood podcast. Today we're joined by Joshua Coombs, founder of Do Something for Nothing. We begin by asking Joshua a little bit about how he got started with this journey and what Do Something for Nothing means.
How did this whole thing come about where you went from being like, I'm going to play guitar to something else?
Yeah, that's actually a really good place to start. Sometimes when I talk about the work I'm doing now, I sort of forget some of the most vital pieces, or what was really like the catalyst for me with all of this stuff. So, I mean, when I was younger, I don't know how many people experienced the same thing, but my secondary school, I went in, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and within about 4 years, the whole thing sucked the life out of me, really. I think it probably wasn't like an authentic moment, personally. I was trying to be somebody the whole time, so even, you know, we're mates with the hard kids, and I was being funny and being like kind of liked was the main goal. I didn't come out with like any GCSEs and any grades to speak of. So actually, like, finishing school, I left with like this pretty huge sense of, you know, failure and feeling like, what is it I'm going to do? Like, what is the next stage for me? And, you know, needless to say, I was kind of messing around and wasn't all that engaged in my schoolwork. But thinking back now, you know, there's definitely some teachers who, yeah, make you sort of feel like this is it, this is the end. But luckily, it kind of changed for me because my auntie gave me her record collection, actually, which was full of all of this 77 punk vinyl from the UK or America, you know, what happened here in London, obviously what's happening in New York and CBGBs and yeah, that kind of really was this injection of what I needed at the time, being this kid who had no direction, didn't know what the future liked whatsoever. But the idea of this kind of movement that happened 30 years before me, even though when I came of age, punk was something that, you know, wasn't ever dead, but it certainly wasn't as prominent. But there was this new punk scene happening, and I bought a guitar, and so did like a lot of people in the town I grew up in, Exeter, and I met kind of my tribe after school, really. So to be really honest, like, people from school, there's not many anyone I keep in touch with, but people outside of that circle, other people who felt the same about music, that was actually one of the most important things that happened to me early on, because from that sense of no GCSEs and feeling like I was failing, guitar was hope, and so was being in a band and being kind of being part of something. And the cool thing about punk music, even though it's like mohawks and piercings sometimes from the outside and has this like fierce spiky exterior, the essence of what it is really incredibly welcoming. You know, if you're weird, then you're in, really. And kind of if you're a bit of an outcast and you don't know what you're up to, it's a great genre to, it kind of brings you in and puts an arm around you. And there was a club in Exeter called the Cavern Club, which I pretty much owe kind of most of who I am today to, because they believed in you and they put our first band's EP out. And, you know, those five friends I met turned into 30 friends. And yeah, honestly, if I was to put down wherever I'm at today, you know, before talking about anything else, it's like it all stems from that moment of, you know, feeling like there was no future to feeling like there was a future. And for me, that all started with music. Yeah.
So was that at that point, like, you know, I know a lot of those references, and there's a huge social conscience present in much of that music, and a political, you know, view, or at least, you know, it offers alternatives to what you might see on regular news stations, for example. So, I mean, was that a conscious thing at the time? Were you just loving the music and the community, or were you already, do you think, like, feeling there's change that I would like to see happen at that stage?
I think it was that political aspect that really spoke to me along with the music. What was great about music, especially like punk rock, is that actually you didn't have to be a very good musician to get started. Like, it wasn't like jazz, you know, you could just, you know, if you learned three chords, you had a punk song. So like there was this really easy, accessible kind of place to get started. But then also, yeah, it was the political aspect, because, you know, it started speaking to me about things I learned, you know, I became educated through music, through The Clash, through Joe Strummer and people like that. And like, you know, that was it just, all I need is, my brain works in a different way, and I need it told to me in a different way, and through music and lyrics. It was all, I was receiving everything, you know. And the Clash, like, it's, you know, their songs range from, you know, what, the war in Vietnam and the Spanish Civil War, to politically what was happening in the UK at the time when they were releasing albums, and the way the world was turning then. But, you know, it reflected all of the things that we still see today. So yeah, that side of things was educational, you know, very educational, and the accessibility was the bit that was also great, because I've definitely worked out in time. I'm much better at things if you can get started straight away, you know, anything that seems like a long way off and you have to study really hard for.
Yeah,
not so good at.
So you're in the cavern, you're playing gigs, you're putting an EP out, you know, you've got this great community, and then all of a sudden, was it like a part-time job thing initially or something?
Actually, do you know what? It took a couple of things to happen in my life where I needed a real transition and change. I'd been touring with different bands, another band called The Computers that I was touring with, like, early 20s, and that all came to an end. Actually, really what happened is I was in a long-term relationship that I kind of completely ended in an absolute explosion, and that was due to me and my fault, and kind of, and it was this kind of moment actually that was pretty profound for me and what I'm later doing now, because I needed a complete change. I had already thought about hairdressing. What happened was music was ending, but my whole life changed slightly, I took a year after that relationship ended to really kind of like do some self-work and put the pieces back together, and I did that as I was training to become a hairdresser. And the first moment, really, to be honest, with getting into hairdressing and that kind of work, it actually wasn't, if I'm, you know, really being transparent, it wasn't because of like some great love for the industry and some passion for like the craft at the time. I really learned to love it, but it was more just that I could play guitar, and I was like, well, I know these hands are good at that kind of thing, not so much at digging holes and
keep looking to the right.
You know, and going and kind of, and for me, I just thought, yeah, how I was naive, because I thought, how hard can it be? I'm going to walk into a salon and see if they can perhaps train me. And it was a friend of a friend whose dad's salon it was. And I ended up, yeah, going in there mid-20s and asking whether there's a chance they could, you know, take me on. And they did, thankfully. And then it was just what I needed as therapy, to be honest, because it was a way to spend time listening to people in the salon. It took my mind off things. I also think it was a really important process for me to go back to square one, like something brand new, where, truth be told, it wasn't that easy training, because, like, you know, I'm there. It's one of the only things where you get watched by the person as you're working on them, you know, when you're training. So it's kind of it's pretty nerve-wracking to begin with, but I built a lot of confidence through that. And I quickly realized, once I got past the kind of moments of anxiety, thinking I was going to ruin someone's life with the wrong snip of the scissors, I ended up realizing that not only was I, of course, giving someone a haircut to make them look and feel good on the outside, but it was that being there for somebody in person and actually listening to them. And you know, some people would just be a bit of chit chat, but other people would really tell you about their lives and really confide in you. And you know, that was, for me, the kind of the part that I hadn't anticipated, that I was incredibly thankful for. And, you know, eventually led me to do this in a different way, in a different environment. That connection is kind of has been the most important part now of cutting hair for me to this day.
So that took you to London, did it? Was that how you moved from Devon? Is that how you came away from Exeter to London for work?
Yeah, exactly. And I knew I wanted a bit of a change, and I was away for a little while in the country, and I came back, and then, decided to move up here, had some pals up here, and it was like, I knew I wanted to come here at some point in my life and spend some time here, and always used to come up here for gigs and stuff anyway, and it just made perfect sense at the time. And yeah, and then working, you know, in a salon, it didn't last as long for me as I thought, because, you know, I was thinking, okay, I'm going to start working and doing this thing now, and yeah, probably, you know, this will be my career. But I was only actually really working in a salon for a couple of years before that changed for me.
Do you remember the first person and the first moment when you stepped out of the salon with all of your gear in the bag, your scissors and the clippers and everything? Do you remember the first time as you left the salon that all of a sudden you completely changed what you were going to use your tools for?
Yeah, I do. I feel like it's, you know, I know I knew something was brewing for me, wanting to like make a bit of a change, because I was always walking, moving up to London. Of course, like any city or town you go to in the UK, you're going to see people who are sleeping rough and people who are hard up. But in London especially, it just became something that I couldn't really, you know, I wasn't ignoring it really. I was going to say I couldn't ignore, but I wasn't, you know, I was doing the things that I could do, like giving someone some pocket change, buying someone a cup of tea or coffee. But I was always intrigued walking off thinking, God, I wish I spent a bit more time talking to that person and found out a bit about their life. And when I was reading articles about homelessness and looking at the statistics, it didn't really make me feel any better, to be honest. And scrolling through social media, all the problems we do face in the world, it can leave you feeling pretty fatigued. Like, how the hell am I, as one person, going to work this thing out when I'm seeing someone at every tube stop, at every supermarket and all that kind of thing. But yeah, the first time I met someone and I actually gave them a haircut, it was a bit of a, I don't know, it wasn't a planned thing. You know, I didn't plan to go out. It was just, I had my backpack with me with, like, I've got these cordless clippers and my scissors and stuff and quite a lot of things that make it mobile to cut hair anywhere. And I was on the way to someone's house to cut their hair and earn a bit of money outside of work, like a bit of pocket money. And yeah, I stopped and spoke to somebody and again, had a chat with them. But this time I remembered, oh, I've got my things on me in my backpack. And it was sort of in that moment I thought, oh yeah, I'm gonna have a chat. And then when the time was right, I asked them if they wanted a haircut and spent the next couple hours with them. You know, obviously the haircut wasn't that long, but it was that particular moment where it was a tipping point for me, because I was thinking about it the wrong way before, perhaps. I was thinking like, you know, I had to come up with some solution to this. And, you know, I didn't see the power as an individual before, like how I could just spend time in that time and how important that is for people when, especially when they're isolated, especially when they're lacking some of those connections in their life usually. And in the moments that I wrapped a cape around someone, you know, I remember quite well, yeah, it was getting all my things out on the floor next to me and, you know, feeling kind of just everything, like the concrete beneath me and being down on that level for an hour, seeing those like footsteps walk by, hundreds of people, because it was a busy area of London. It was quite an injection of empathy straight away for like just the environment. And then what came with that was how this act of a haircut provided, like, as I said, like this great moment in the mirror at the end where I, you know, made someone look good and kind of cleaned them up. But it wasn't that really that struck with me straight away. It was just having somebody there outside of their usual circle, coming to them where they are on the street, because I think that part's important, and just spending some time with no strings attached. Because, you know, the next time that I saw this person afterwards, it wasn't, oh, can you cut my hair again? Can you cut my hair again? It was like, hey, here's what I've been up to. I want to tell you about this and this and this. And it was sharing how they were in that time. And yeah, they introduced me then to their friends. And I started going out more often and doing this, you know, regularly on a day off. Some evenings I'd go out with my backpack. I'd get a bit more prepared and take some things that made more sense to cut hair outside, like some dry shampoo that you can spray someone's hair with before. And yeah, do all I could, you know, to make it as close to the salon as possible. And it wasn't long before I started like sharing these stories, because I realized the people I was meeting, it just dissolved all these stigmas that I think surround this issue, because that for me is like one of the biggest problems we got to get past, is there's all these really negative stereotypes surrounding it. And the people I was meeting, it just dissolved all of that within a few weeks.
So that's the turning point in them making this experience public, right? Because you've met a bunch of people, you've seen the transformation, but you're wanting to now communicate that. It's not just, you know, it's one thing, it's quite a personal act, it's quite an individual thing to work with, you know, with a person on a one-to-one and, you know, spend that time, that no strings attached thing. But then it's like, oh, I need to share this with more people. So did the hashtag and everything come out of, you know, the whole thing come out of that first post?
Well, yeah, actually, I was thinking of like a hashtag that would be cool to connect with it. And I remember texting my friend Helen, who I used to work in the salon with, and I was like, does this sound all right? We sort of came up with it together while I was like sat somewhere. And I was like, yeah, I just thought I wanted to come up with something. So do something for nothing is the hashtag. And I started when I didn't used to use Instagram and that very much. And when I did, it was always left me feeling weird at how many likes you get when your face is the feature of the photo, you know? And it's like, I just, I've just suddenly realized like this is a good place to try and share this stuff. And I thought the hashtag would be good because it provides other people with an opportunity to say, what's your version of this? You know, I already knew that the haircut wasn't the main focus for me. It was about this, you know, going out, getting over those feelings of sat at home, as I said earlier on, the feeling fatigued, sat on the sofa, scrolling through Twitter and turn it into some form of action. And yeah, that was the decision to post this stuff on Instagram. I'm really thankful for that because it's such a great image sharing platform, and it's changed a bit now, but still it's a great place to stop people while they're scrolling with this before and after photo. Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe actually I could share my screen and go through like a couple of those now. Mm-hmm. I might try and do that. Yeah. So, you know, the way that I do things usually, and this is the hashtag, is you know, when I meet people, I was given more haircuts and I started to travel to different places, but I'll always do these before and after pictures of different people that I meet. And sometimes obviously it is like quite a drastic transformation, which is beautiful. But this was the signpost that would stop people scrolling on Instagram and on social media and hopefully stop for, you know, a few minutes and read onto their story. And I just, you know, write what happened between us on that day. I was never really obsessed with the exact reason of why somebody became homeless. I was more interested in kind of what people liked and what they enjoyed. And I think they're just as valid questions. I think when people are, you know, like people experiencing homelessness, I feel like one of the biggest mistakes I was making before was forgetting about people's identity beyond this word, you know, like all the hopes, dreams and passions and wants and desires and, you know, all the things that we all have. And I was trying to get to know people on that level. And these photos and these images were, yeah, as I said, a really good way to hopefully get people in a bit deeper. And obviously social media is not all that easy to do that with our attention span. And but it was working, you know, and it was working really well. And people started to share these photos, but then the hashtag became this space where other people got involved with smaller actions, you know, and not small compared to what I was doing, but I just mean even, for instance, it was people using like tangible skills and time, which was beautiful. Like there was like yoga teachers and dance teachers going into rehabilitation centers and volunteering their time. Sometimes it was things more simple, like there were some students who went in to have lunch with some senior citizens who don't have any family who go in to see them. Mm-hmm. And even sometimes just people, I don't know, it may seem like, you know, a small thing, but someone helping their neighbor with their shopping home and you know, just those really neighborly things I think were really nice too. So the hashtag became a space for people to share. And for me, it's when things started to grow and it got picked up a bit by the media. And then I ended up quitting my job before too long after a few months of doing this and started to travel, you know, all over the place to keep telling these stories and keep kind of putting this message out there. And that was actually, you know, a decision that I'm so glad for now. At the time, I didn't know exactly kind of like where I was going to go and what I was going to do, but I was relying on friends initially who I knew who might have a spare sofa or a spare room. And I went out to a few places in America, went over to Paris, which has become a place I go to a lot and do this. So things started to kick off.
Do something for nothing is a movement rather than an individual. It's not about promoting one way of doing things, even never that, you know, it's not about you. You know, you're doing this thing where you're leading the way with your skill, and you're doing that with people that are living on the streets, right? So you've got this approach which is like, I can do this, I give my time, I listen, you know, it's open-hearted, you're not expecting any return. In fact, it explicitly it doesn't involve money, you know, like you're going there to do it because you want to do it. But like you say, it creates an opportunity for anybody and society, you know, to think about what it is you can give. Like, you know, in what way could I be of service to my local surroundings and what it might need, you know, and that can be specifically people living on the streets around you. It could be that you notice other things, like you said, helping someone with their shopping home, you know, just being conscious and noticing what needs there are local to where you are, and then what it is that you can offer to bring about a little bit more harmony and equilibrium.
Definitely. And it's, you know, it's like, these are four words that, you know, this is part of, for me, an inherent part of being a human being. We wouldn't have evolved to live in these citadels of like many, many people. And when you look around, sometimes you think, how do we get here? And it wasn't certainly from, you know, it was from sharing initially and kind of like living in these smaller communities. And you know, that's why I won't debate anyone on whether that's an inherent part of like being a human is kind of looking out for one another. And of course that used to be more primal and now we've evolved past that. But I think the danger is now we do need a healthy injection of this, I think, because we're living in like the most distracted time that we ever have. We're busier than ever. For every new technology and everything that we're, no one gets any more leisure time. This new world we're in, we're working even harder and longer hours. So the machine's churning and we're doing more and working more. And sometimes I speak to people and I do it too, you know, I don't know when to stop working, you know, and work bleeds into everything. And you sort of go, was this the promised land, you know, way back sort of 50, 60 years ago, when we sort of saw the future? And look, my point is that Do Something Up is my version of it and other people are using it in some way, but this is what people do anyway. We all do this when we remember. You try and look at your bus driver and say hello when you get on the bus rather than just tapping the card, you know? Yeah. And you try and, you know, when you see someone's not in a good way, you might ask if they're all right. So this isn't revolutionary. It's a big reminder and I'm so honestly, it means a lot to me when other people use this specifically because it's a place where I can see it, but they'd be doing those things anyway, which is beautiful. And it's very hopeful for me, especially when I go into schools and give talks and that kind of fresh thinking next generation, you know, it's hopefully embedding some of this for the future that I'm really passionate about. And I know it's not easy sometimes too, as well, because I do know that we're busy and, you know, sometimes we don't want to talk to anyone and it's all relative to your day and how things are going. But when you have the time, you know, when you're presented with that moment, which I think we all are in at some stage in our life, it's like getting a bit out of your comfort zone and reaching out to people. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend it's always easy when I'm going out and doing this, because people are in a bad way. It's a very sensitive place people are in when they're living in like one of the harshest environments, like out in the elements, wondering where you're going to sleep. There's issues with addiction, there's mental health issues, there's all kinds of complications that come with this lifestyle. But it's taught me so much because, you know, there's a shield and a barrier to a lot of this stuff that I realized before existed for me. And in penetrating it, I've realized that it was mostly my own callus that I'd built to like just get in the way of the interaction. The reality is people are humans, and I try and read people's energy when I'm going over to say hello and check out what's going on. But, you know, there's these layers that start appearing, and we all have them when we're in a certain amount of pain or we've been through trauma in our life. And sometimes those layers are really, really thick. And you know, I just now know that if I don't get that kind of initial interaction with someone, I'll go back and see them a few times, and it's about building trust. And God, as far as like learning about, you know, humans and these experiences I've had, like I'm incredibly grateful for them, for my own. I try and understand myself as well as part of this journey.
One bad judgmental person who doesn't think I'm a human being, there's 9 Mancunians who support me, give me hope, give me love, get me a cup of tea, get me something to eat, go, John, we can't wait to see you back on your feet. That's what keeps me going. And the likes of the lads like yourselves who stop and give me 5 minutes of time. So just thank you.
All these people don't seem to realise that before we were homeless, we had lives as well. I've been reading my book, right, because I read a lot now. I've had quite a few people surprised that I'm even reading at all, you know.
I'll get people walk past me every single day. That'll stop. Probably get 5 people out there, 100 people that I'll walk past me. That'll stop the chance of them. Which is a shame, really. It's a shame.
a lot back because I have a lot of love inside me. If you get love, you have to give love back. And I don't know in what kind of way you have to give it back, but it's the little things that count, you know?
You know what I've learned now? I started to love people, you know?
Understand why it is necessary that we all are together, you know?
Keep it safe with each other. That's what life's all about.
You don't want to live here for a long time, but if you stay for a short time, I think you get to know who you really are and who other people are.
Have a little bit of love, spread it, it's not just you. Do you know what I mean? We're all in this shit together. We all came into this world the same way, we'll all go out the same way. We all end up in the same size fucking box.
Yeah, it's incredibly moving.
Well, we've got you to thank for the score there, Matt. Matthew Shaw on the music there, which I'm very grateful for, because well, it's important with this stuff, I think, to try and let it guide itself, because look, like, sometimes shooting this and doing this, you know, I've learned how to use a camera a bit more, and it's always nice to capture these moments, and it's not ever like really high production, but I quite like it because it's the street and it's the feel. And I think the messages and some of the things that I hear from people, it's incredibly profound. And I think one of the reasons for that is you're confronted with a side of life that some of us have to flirt with from time to time when we're not in a good position. But when you've lost it all, at least materialistically speaking, you know, you're left with yourself and you're left with the humans around you who either give a shit about you or they don't. And it tunes people into a part of themselves, which I think we could all take a lesson from. And, you know, not in some exploitative, voyeuristic way, just in a way of not only is it important to listen to people for their own well-being, but for me on a personal level, like, you know, I meet people who are street shamans to me, people I spent like a day or two with on end and followed them around the city. And it's important. I think it's important to some of the people I see, they're seeing it all day, the city and how things work and how people interact in their everyday beelines towards whatever they're doing that day. So there's a perspective that's very, very profound sometimes.
Yeah. And what really struck me reading this and hearing you describe the stories and quoting people as you're chatting to them is the amount of love and empathy and compassion and will to help other people. But it doesn't just come from you, right? The really surprising thing, maybe it's not surprising, but one of the things that I had to keep remembering as I was reading the book is the generosity, the love, the compassion, the empathy is from every single person, almost 100% of the people that you meet. And there's a couple of exceptions where people disappear and you don't know where they are, you don't know what happened, right? But then you've got all of the people where seemingly have almost nothing, seemingly are at a point, you know, and actually in terms of possession, security, finance, fixed abode, bank accounts, jobs, and all, like none of those things there. And yet, if they see somebody or meet somebody that they consider to be less well off than they are, even given all of those factors, they're the first people to offer generosity and to offer help. It comes up again and again and again, that theme.
Yeah, I think it comes down to the fact that, you know, when you're when you're removed from the world of possessions that we hold on to so dearly around us, that's what you've got, and you realize that you have to share, like I said earlier, to survive. But it is beautiful, because that generosity is incredible, really. It's incredible the amount of people I've met who are generous to one another in that sense. Like, you know, sometimes, of course, like anywhere, you know, any walk of life, it can be a bit dog eat dog. It depends on who you are. But there's times where, you know, I met this family in Skid Row. Skid Row is one of these areas of Los Angeles, which is like, you know, basically a 30 to 50 block radius of tents. It's a big tent city in downtown LA, or just, you know, neighboring to downtown LA. And, you know, it's incredible how dehumanized people are there, and how it's all left. And, you know, it's just, you know, it's really, the conditions are awful. But, you know, I started going down there more and getting to know people, and I was staying there for a couple months. And I met this family who, not only were they generous with their time, but they also, I know for a fact, I could have slept there that night if I needed to, you know. And I could have, they probably would have offered me a drink and something if I needed to too. I'm just gonna, like, as I talk about this, I've just realized that they're in these photos that I've got here. So this is Skid Row in LA, and you can see obviously, like, the tents really do line the streets, and it is hard to know what to do when you've got, you know, when you're confronted with this. But that's where, as you're saying, like, the film, the documentary side of it, the kind of photography, anywhere you can try and express this stuff, and I personally think creatively, is really important, because sometimes it is a bit too harsh when, look, you just got those images of kind of these tents. It's even more important to try and tell the stories of people behind them. And this is that family I was talking about, Adam, Tiffany, and Brandon. And obviously, you know, they've got a young child there, and you'll find that a lot in the United States. There's a, you know, families living out of cars and people living in tents, and it's real, you know. It's really, it's the tourists don't get to see much of it, but you know, nor actually a lot of the residents. But when you go down there and you start sniffing around, you realize this stuff is happening. And you know, these guys, as you mentioned, with generosity, they were so lovely. They came along, and they I had this little video that I won't play now, but they offered me anything I needed, and I cut Adam's hair and we hung out. But when I go back now, I always go back and see them, and they're in the book, actually. So yeah, Adam, Tiffany, and Brandon are inside the book, and you probably read about them.
Yeah. It's particularly in the US, in those chapters when you're in the different US cities, so many people are working jobs, and not just one job, sometimes many jobs. So it's not a simple situation that you've got somebody living on the street in a tent, but it could well be that there's a long-term employment thing going on there as well. So they're still working a regular job, they're still, you know, paying tax, they're still doing all the things that somebody with a, you know, living in a house or an apartment or a flat would be doing. Mm-hmm. So it's really quite complex in terms of how those relationships work, isn't it?
It is. It really is. And I think that, you know, for all the will in the world, even for, say, you know, the more compassionate mainstream media channels, which, you know, is very hard for any of them to really go that much deeper. A lot of the time it's these wide angle shots from afar that, as I said, are quite dehumanizing. And, like, you know, that's 90% of people's view of this. Like, some, you know, you've got to remember, like, it's getting beamed into someone's TV, and that's their view of this issue. And it's like, that's why it's even more important. There's incredible people all over doing everything they can to tell stories. I meet amazing people, from, you know, my friend Aji in Paris, to this guy I know, Paulie, in LA, going out on Skid Row all the time. There's incredible photographers who are trying to tell these stories in different ways. And I think that's where it's even more important to use anything you have to sort of get beyond the surface of this issue. And yeah, my version of that here is now the book, because all these stories I was posting on Instagram and social media, that's great, but it is quite short-lived, you know, and it takes one person to start following to maybe scroll back. But the good thing is, here, having it here, and actually this is the UK cover here as well, so it's the same book inside, but we've got two different covers for the different editions. But it's full up with stories of different people, and the hope is that will go a long way to, you know, reach people who aren't on social media, and from different categories, different age brackets, and different people who are interested in having this tangible thing to pick up. And of course, with the stories, there's themes that run through underneath them. And I think they're the kind of themes that we can all relate to, you know, the things that happen in our lives that sometimes we haven't got any control over, that actually are just, you know, they're on the horizon for all of us. But you can only hope that when something like that happens, you've got a support network and you've got people around you. And often people ask me, like, what's the reason why, if you could put it down to one reason, why someone ends up living on the street? And of course, you have all these like surface reasons and factors that contribute to that first night someone would be faced with the prospect of finding somewhere in a city to curl up and close your eyes. But you're also underneath it, I'd always say that it's this support network, you know, this kind of lack of a safety net. Because sometimes I think about like where I'd go if I, you know, had £0 in my bank account, I'd you know, lost any form of like getting any money anytime soon, couldn't pay my rent, you know, in a vulnerable position financially. But then, you know, where would I go if I had my backpack? And I think about friends I'd go and stay with in London first until, you know, I annoyed, you know, boyfriends or girlfriends got annoyed with me and they kicked me out. And I'd, you know, then I'd move along a bit. I'd probably go down to Bristol and knock on my sister's door there on the way down to Devon, where I'd finally go back to, you know, my mum and my sister there. And then, you know, it wouldn't be that easy to knock on people's door. And the point I want to get to with this is you've got to remember, we all have a sense of pride, and to go down and like knock on someone's door, even who you know cares about you. I've spoken to people who do have someone and they don't even want to, they don't want to reach out to them because they don't want someone to know they're in this position. Because yeah, pride is like a incredible thing we hold on to as people, and it's a shame, but you know, we can all relate to that. And some people, they might even have that door they can knock on, but they're like, I don't want to see someone like this. Like, I don't want anybody to see me like this. And you know, if they're dirty and they don't look themselves and they're ashamed of themselves. And that's kind of what's in here too, as well, is like, hopefully those nuances in people's lives that we can just forget about this word homelessness, even though of course it's very on point, you know, and it's what I do, but it's like, this is a human conversation I try and have in here, and less of a political one, more than just one that hopefully people can relate to on those finer points.
For me, it feels like, you know, it's the cycles. Move back to the first point. You start off in the Cavern in Exeter at punk rock shows, and then you're using art as a way of, you know, engaging people emotionally with the stories you've found over the last 5 years. It's, you know, it's...
Yeah, well, exactly. And, you know, I failed my art GCSE, failed my English GCSE. So yeah, I'm trying to tick them off as I go through life. But yeah, it's cool. It's cool because, yeah, for me, that's how I see things. And I try and work with people who have similar ideas, because I'm just like, oh, it's a way of expressing things sometimes where the message is once removed. And of course, it's literal here in words, like I, you know, that's a great form of communicating. But through the art pieces and through the video and through the photography, sometimes it is quite hard to stare like suffering right in the face and our own suffering or other people's. And it's trying to sort of just, you know, ease in these messages through other means. And yeah, that's what I'm passionate about.
Thank you.
love with conditions isn't love at all. It's scientific, it's objective. There's a goal, and the goal is the condition to be met. But when there's no condition, it's just joyful freedom. That is the best kind of love. And it's, you know, it's acceptance, and it's forbearance, and it's tolerance, and it's enjoyment, and it's all of these things that you go through just to nurture and sustain a loving feeling. Whether it be for another person, or for your career, or your private endeavor, haircutting, or my cello playing, or whatever it is, my love for the cello is unconditional. The cello asks me for nothing. It doesn't even ask me to practice. I do that. I bring that to the table. So that's unconditional.
My message to the world, stay true to yourself and be yourself. Don't try to be a copycat of anybody you see. The best thing you can be is be you. Be you.
I cannot buy back one moment in time. That's the most precious gift you have to give anyone. If you give a person your time, you cannot buy it back. You cannot spend $1 trillion a day to buy back a moment in time. It's the most valuable gift you have to give anyone.
What does that mean?
This is a birthmark. It means that I have the heart of a lion. It means doing what you gotta do.
No, this was just it was a gifted to me, actually.
Right now, I just really like it.
And one thing about me, my hands always stay dirty for some reason. Like, I've learned myself. Like, I've learned a lot about myself, like who I am, I think. Even the negative stuff, man, you gotta like see it. Like, you know, you gotta like face it one time, you know, like. Cause then you become the real you. Not the person that you always claim to be, but like who you really are. You know, and once you do that, like that. You know, it's like that monster under the bed, kinda like, you know, he's not that bad no more. Like, yeah.
Like that, man.
And it gets so dark that you won't see fear no more, so. You no longer see fear, so from now on you see clear.
Yeah, I'll be 67 in August.
So 70.
Well, I'm pushing the big days. Like I said, I lost my brother at 59. Oh, well, that was the hardest thing in my life, man. I hated the Lord for a while because you took my brother away from me. Then I thought about it when I was walking around the park. And, okay. He's in good place. Thank you, Lord. I'm sorry what I said. You know, I just, you know, just. This is my mom, my aunt, my uncle, and that's him. But I love my brother so much. I don't want to cry. I'm tired of crying.
From my black ass, the most hated. I don't know why, but I know Jesus black. And a whole bunch of you gonna be surprised. Peace of mind. Peace of mind. Yeah. Simple peace of mind. I got peace. Why I say peace? I got peace now. Y'all got problems. You gotta go to work. Your co-workers, all that.
Well, really, I'm crazy, but I'm crazy that that make my decisions are being made not by me, but with the help of God, you know. And if you tell me that that's wrong, you're right. Tell me if anyone else out there have ever done something like this, right? Because I had doubts as you had doubts, and I also feel exactly the same way as you feel. And I gotta tell you something, the rest of them who wouldn't do that have now more doubts than we have now, just like that. But I'll tell you, it's that God made this connection, and I know that, in fact, and God wants to bless us. And I gotta tell you something, I will always consider, it's like, you always be with me.
Money, you know what they say, you know when people say money is the root of all evil? That quote is incorrect. It's love of money is the root of all evil. That's what it says in the Bible. So it's wrong. There's a difference. That makes a difference, doesn't it?
You know Jesus Christ? He lives in my body. Ex-mayor Ed Lee.
More positive. I'm not motivated, I put it that way, to do a lot of things, you know? I'm just tired, and, you know, not... I also like it because the vulnerability comes out of the athletes there, because nobody's perfect. And nobody wants... and nobody expects them to be perfect. It depends on a lot of times on what you want to see.
Jump in them crossroads. One time it's cold. And I spoke with the devil, and he said to me, would you sell me your soul for a piece of gold? Would you sell me your soul for a piece of gold?
Thank you for listening to Stories That Matter, the Hawkwood podcast. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, tell your friends, sign up to our mailing list, or on social media.